Welcome to the Inclusive Education Project. I'm Vicki Brett.
I'm Amanda Salohi. We're two civil rights lawyers on a mission to change the conversation about education, civil rights, and modern activism.
Each week, we're going to explore new topics which are going to educate and empower others
and give them a platform to enact change in education and level the playing field. Welcome back, friends.
Hi, hi, hi. You sound exhausted. The school year is weighing on
me?
You.
Oh, yeah. I feel like this week I've had so many IEPs. I think I said this last week, but it's just, it's longer IEPs. You know, we get there somewhere. I mean, it's not as exhausting as like we used to do. Like if I had like two-hour IEPs and I was driving from LA to like Riverside, that was more exhausting. But sometimes just the mental energy of like being on for these IEP meetings, because there's so many details that we try to keep in mind. And it's unfortunate that not every IEP team member like feels that way about an IEP. Like sometimes it's going through the motions. Sometimes it's, you know, you got your computer and you're going through other stuff, writing emails, or, you know, you think, okay, well, it's not my part, so I don't really have to listen. And I think that's to some extent what we're going to get into today about talking about IEP teams. And
It was so funny because as you were saying, going through the motions, I was like, I'll tell you someone who doesn't go through the motions. And I was just going to lead right into Andrew. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on our podcast.
Thank you so much, Vicki and Amanda. It's such a privilege to be here.
So we just kind of wanted to throw it to you to introduce yourself really briefly to our listeners. And then we're going to kind of get into a topic that you had wanted to kind of hear like our perspective, and we're dying to hear your perspective. So can you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, my name is Andrew Goff. And to give the skinny, I taught early childhood special education in five different least restrictive environments over the course of 11 years and 12 years. I apologize. You know how they kind of just come together. Forget after a little while. You know, the five different least restrictive environments have really given me a level of insight that I brought into the doctoral program that I went into in 2014, 2015, graduated in 2017, and then brought my knowledge both in the field and from my education over to the community college system in Colorado. And I've worked at two different community colleges, and I'm now the coordinator and lead instructor at Colorado Northwestern Community College, about 45 minutes west of Steamboat Springs, if that means anything to anybody.
It might.
Maybe. Oh, I appreciate your kind of perspective of like you've gone through the like ages. You've gone through the like you haven't just taught one age group, which not that there's anything wrong with that, but oftentimes we talk about in IEP meetings, or we, and when I say we, I mean like Vicki and I and like our team, like we try to look ahead at the skills that are necessary for a child's future, not just elementary school, middle school, high school, but like beyond, and consider what are some tools, what are skills that we need to be developing and considering other than reading, writing, and arithmetic. And so I think your perspective is great because you've seen both sides of it, of like, what are these kids lacking when they get to community college or college, and like when they get to that age, or what skills did they really need?
You know, and it's fascinating working with students at the community college because they're non-traditional learners in most cases. And they've, you know, a large percentage have gone through the public education system with IEPs. And, you know, one of my favorite courses is the Exceptional Child, ECE 2601, where, you know, there's just as much self-searching as there is understanding our own experiences as we navigate the world and as we navigate the education system, because most of them are currently teachers. And hearing their perspectives on, you know, thinking retrospectively about that experience and this, you know, a lot of them develop this motivation to, you know, advocate for ages, you know, across the spectrum, because they look back on their experiences and they say, you know, I think it's really hard to have those conversations and not say what if, but it's you. I mean, they're in college. So it's like, y'all are doing so well and you're working hard and you're passionate, but you know, it's looking back and saying, what if, you know, who's making these decisions back, you know, in this case, you know, 1995, 2000, who's making those decisions, and it really wasn't them. And there's a lot of dissonance in that for them because, you know, as a system, it's families at the center. And I always promote that, you know, we want to focus on families. And at what point in time do we start to think about the child's future? Like you're talking about, you know, are we doing that already? We usually don't think transitions until, you know, 14, 13. Right. And so what are we doing when they're 3, 4, 5? Well, they're still at the center of their family, but do we need to start considering that?
Yeah. Absolutely. And from Ann and I in California, we are moving towards getting our 3 and 4 year olds. We just started kind of transitional kindergarten. So 4 and 5 year olds, I think it's like the second year. Some districts had already kind of been offering that, but really as a state as a whole, we're offering public school classrooms for these kiddos. And, you know, I personally am experiencing the TK public school system, and it's wild. Like we already kind of, you know, as we're introducing kiddos earlier and earlier into the public school, where before really 2.5 to 3, if the child was a regional center, we have regional centers in California, provide services to kiddos with autism and a various other plethora of unique needs, they could be the first ones to turn over to the district and say, hey, you have to evaluate this kid, see if they need an IEP. We're going to see a whole realm of kiddos that may not have been assessed until maybe second, third grade, potentially be assessed earlier, which is wonderful. But I can imagine with your time in early education, and just a quick plug for your memoir, Love is a Classroom, which we were going to get into one chapter specifically because it hits the nail on the head of, you know, this idea of inclusion, but the, as you had put it, you know, the line between compliance and these relationships, which, you know, who do I serve? I think that's what you had said, something along those lines. And it's like, well, the child, but it's like, no, child and families. And I think that that gets missed a lot with some of the professionals that we deal with.
And even you mentioned the transition planning, you know, doesn't start till 14. Like that is the minimum requirement under the IDEA, that by 14, we need to start transition planning, including a transition plan in the IEP in terms of what the law says. But there's nothing in the law that says we can't start transition planning sooner. And that's the distinction that I'm sure you see, and I know we've talked about, that we have school districts that are so focused on compliance of these are the things that we need to do that we forget these are the things that we could do earlier on, and we could be looking at all of these things earlier on, and maybe we're not going to be as like have to be like have huge transition plans when they turn 14 because we've already started to develop these skills, but we're not doing it.
And while I was writing the book, you know, the book was written with a lot of self-reflection and just like therapy, like I need to process the situation. And the initial drafts, there was a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of animosity and a lot of built up anger and this conglomeration of emotions where I wanted to put blame on the district. Like this was all their fault. But then my editor was like, Andrew, you might want to back off a little bit. Like just step back and think about this. And so I did. I stepped back and I thought about it from a variety of different angles and just reflected. And I was like, you know, I don't blame the district for a lot of this. You know, it was a huge school district. I'll leave it at that. And they don't want to get lawsuits, rightfully so. And so when you're trying to balance that out, you know, where's this priority? You know, are we at what point in time? And a lot of this comes down to how are we distributing, I think, our leadership, and how are we really leveraging the resources and strengths and prioritizing where, you know, people should be spending their time, which I'm sure that's a conversation that you're talking about right now. And, you know, as you're finishing up the years, how are we delegating our time to finish all this up? Teachers are saying, I've got to teach this class and I need to focus on this and I need to get this all done. You know, my kids just finished their state tests. And so it's like, how do we accommodate all that? But, you know, thinking about who is going to be making those decisions early on and who should be responsible for that. And I think there's just, you know, there's no straight line. And I, you know, we're governed by politics, by policy. And that tries to, you know, it tries to keep everything literally in black and white. And there's nothing black and white about serving children with disabilities. So I think, there's a lot of conflict in there that I had to reconcile and then say, okay, it's not the district's fault. This is a broader issue of how are we investing our time? And you talked about this expansion of TK, and here we just in Colorado, we started universal pre-K this year. And so there's this huge expansion, but that brings in all this broader conversation of, we don't have the resources in our program, but legally we can't turn children away. That's discrimination. Colorado has some pretty strong anti-discrimination laws. So yeah, where are we putting that time and energy, and who's responsible, and how are we actually, and we can give responsibility, I think rightfully so, to certain people, but then also like, Trisha, like there's no reason to be Trisha, who's that, a character in the chapter that you're referring to. There's no reason for that type of disposition. And I would say it doesn't really do us any good to, put it on one person, because we can't really advance the conversation.
I mean, we touched a lot about just the lack of training and the need for more training for teachers, but not just teachers. I mean, anyone that's working with these kiddos, not just on like disabilities and how to teach kids with disabilities, but sometimes I feel even just, I don't want to say common sense, but like thinking outside the box, being creative, having compassion for others, and like how we're teaching that to children, because it's not just that we're teaching kids their ABCs, reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? We are teaching them to be productive and good members of society. And we sometimes forget that part of it, of teaching compassion comes from being compassionate in the first place.
Yeah, and being part of a compassionate community. And that's one of the, you made me think about this as we're thinking about transitions, and do we start that conversation early on? And one of the challenges that I experienced, especially, so I continued teaching after that year for two more school years. And what I, there were a lot of lessons that I learned throughout that, that I, I've walked through in the book and processed through that story. And I started to recognize, how much we do in early childhood, whether that be early intervention, the birth to three part C component, or, this 3 to 5, we can create these compassionate communities and these loving communities that are focused on social skills. And there's really no disability. The kid is thriving and they're not disabled, and how much this is contextual. And then they get over to kindergarten,
I
or they
know.
transition into a general pre-K classroom. And all of a sudden it is, this kiddo needs an IEP. This kiddo needs to be evaluated. And that, I think probably there's a level of that for you all and teacher struggle. And then there's, I hear it from my own students, like, because of ratios, we can't support this kiddo. Like, they're sticking another kiddo with an IEP in here because it's deemed the least restrictive environment. And we can't do this. And it's like, well, I mean, you kind of can, and you don't have the training really to be able to do that. And I think another thing in that story that I want people to see is how important my teaching assistants were, that it can't just be the teacher with the training, that it has to be, it has to be the teacher who has the training. It has to be the teaching assistants or the paraprofessionals who have the training. It has to be like a wider understanding. And one of the things that really privileged me coming into that year that I describe, or that I share in the book, is that I had worked in a self-contained classroom, a center program, for 2 years prior to that, which is like, it equipped me with a lot of skills, and trying to just create a welcoming, compassionate community in there where every single child has an IEP. And we're like, we still need peer models in here. How can we create peer models in a self-contained classroom? And so I think that was an asset that you can't teach in a college class. You can't prepare in a professional development. Like, you have to develop those skills in the trenches, which, that also brings in these conversations that I'm part of, is how do we move away from so much focus on self-contained classrooms as the least restrictive environment? And I think part of that conversation is, how do we allow teachers in self-contained classrooms, or classrooms where there are intensive needs, to feel empowered to bridge those skills that they've developed in there to support inclusive classrooms. Because that was, those are priceless lessons that I learned in that classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think something that you pointed out as well is there is this kind of mantra of, you know, you're the teacher, you know what's best for the classroom, you know, you're the parent, you're the expert of your child. And, you know, the helplessness that you felt in that moment when this administrator was just like going the complete opposite. You're just trying to move him to the afternoon class. We might need another para. We need the bus. And she's like, sounds like he needs home services. He can't move, you know, and it was just so like, you know, and we've felt that, we've seen that time and time again. And I think, you know, to touch on what Amanda had said, like the creativity kind of goes out the window. I mean, you guys were able to make it work because two other kiddos had moved out of your class, right? Certain things had fallen into place, but even your principal, you know, was trying to be creative. And I think that oftentimes, and it's top down, if you have somebody that's so focused on compliance, you have almost somebody that is putting special education into this box and then refuses, like yeah. Amanda said, to think outside of that box where, you know, that's not what special education is about. We can have a child with Down syndrome be in a general education classroom. We're not saying throw academics out the door, but it could be done. And it has been done, but we oftentimes just hit this wall with districts, and it's because the teacher is not confident in their abilities, or they need more help and resources. And even though they're asking for it, they're just met with a no, 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 no. And that's what's really hard. And yes, sometimes we come in and we sue and then we get it, right? But we don't represent every child in that classroom. We don't represent, you know, and that's what almost makes it heartbreaking, in that the system is so broken. And so many people know that yeah. and are trying to fix it. And it's tough. You know, on an individual basis, what we can do is incredible for that family. But, you know, the purpose of our podcast and having people like you on is so that we can start these conversations and make these issues known on like a broader level, not just like, oh, you had a kid and then you experienced it, right? Like, you know, having a little bit of information beforehand and really being able to know how to change it is helpful. If for our listeners, what's something that you would encourage them to take with them, you know, being on the other side of that table, right? Of the little kid table when they're at an IEP meeting? Because I know you had mentioned the mother of the particular child, you know, she kind of wasn't there. She was physically there, but at times, you know, you were just like, hey, is everything okay? What's something that you wish parents knew before going into a big IEP? Or she didn't even know it was a big IEP meeting, but just from your experience, something that they can take with them into these meetings.
Yeah, I think the biggest piece, retrospectively, plain, and I try to talk about this a lot in my class. This is like the main point of the classes that I teach is you are an advocate. Like, you may not have the special ed credentials, but now you've been through this class and you understand what an IFSP is and you understand what mm-hmm. an IEP is, or at least the general principles of it. And so if you can get a draft of that IEP, which if you're part of this team, you should be able to see a draft of that. You should be participating in that team to, mm-hmm. you know, to get everything set up. But, you know, take a look at that, share that with the family, prepare them, because once everybody mm-hmm. gets to the table, I mean, we know this. It's like, everybody's got an hour on their schedule. Like, it's got to start at 1 p.m. because that's like when we can get all 12 people there. Mm-hmm. And it's going to end at 2 p.m. because then someone's got to go off somewhere else. We have no choice. And in the meantime, you know, I can't even imagine. I've got two kids of my own. And just going into a parent-teacher conference with just my wife, me, and my kids, you know, one of my daughters, that's overwhelming. And so yeah. to be in the situation that Chanel was in with Javon is a whole mm-hmm. different ballgame. Mm-hmm. But what I'd really encourage teachers to do is first understand what the IEP is and how it fits into the broader context of this family. Like, where does this fit into the context of what the priorities are with the family? Because the teachers know the children better than anyone else at that table. You know, you got the speech pathologist with, you know, in a good circumstance or a best case scenario, they're coming in and they're providing those services in the classroom for maybe an hour or 2 hours a week, and they get to meet the children, you know, because you had mentioned a little bit earlier that it's, you work with that one child, you know, as mm-hmm. as you're working with the family and you're trying to serve as their legal advisor, you're working with that one, but we're talking about a classroom of, you know, 15 other kids or mm-hmm. 18 other kids, or who knows how many mm-hmm. kids, depending on the age. And mm-hmm. so the teacher understands how this child fits in to the classroom community. And so one, requesting to have a voice at the table, if possible, having the teaching assistants have a voice at the table mm-hmm. and saying, here's how this child fits into this community. Or this is how we could see this child fit into the community. You know, I saw it in the book as, let's move him to the afternoon class because that seemed like a better community and or a more suitable community. And so teachers to say, okay, let's have everybody who understands the child in the context and let's discuss this in advance. Like, let's prepare the family for what's mm-hmm. possibly to come. And decide, you know, what role we can serve. Maybe it's, you know, as the teacher, they're not the case manager. They really don't. There could be like 2 minutes for them to provide their input. But the parents, it's the parents' IEP meeting. So the parent can say, I would like that teacher to share a little bit more. There yeah. are some parents who have the confidence and have the knowledge mm-hmm. to be able to step forward. Right. I think teachers really can help strengthen anybody's confidence, though. But that starts out with the teacher having the relationship with the kids.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, compliance, when we talk about compliance, the line between compliance and compassion, it's not just compliance for IEPs. Like, we have, as teachers, we are expected to comply with so many other things. And the district's not going to get sued. Well, they could for not serving English language learners or dual language learners. But in general, those other policies are not going to be at the, you know, in front of the burner in the way that the policies for the IEP are. So, you know, the right. teacher just having that knowledge, being able to advocate, and the more they come in as a team player, I think that that really opens the door, and nobody on that team is going to object to a teacher who wants to be part of this. I think that it's just, I don't think a lot of special ed teams really consider bringing the teaching assistants or the paras into the IEP meeting. And, you know, from a para perspective, that's not their job responsibility. That's, they're getting right. paid perhaps minimum wage, mm-hmm. but they love the children too.
Yeah.
And so they should also be there.
And we would yeah. love that. We often ask for the parents to be there. In fact, it's yeah. probably one of the people that we ask the most. They're the ones that spend the most time with the child if it's a full-time para. More often than not, I'd say 99% of the time, the answer is no. We get that answer from the school districts because they know that being a low-wage worker, they're probably going to be the most honest and open, and that's not always
I'm sure part they of have the reasons liability purposes yep. But yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head. And just also lastly, to kind of bring it back, you know, knowing that for that particular child, the afternoon class, and then when you did broach the subject with mom, her saying, you know what, that actually works with his doctor's appointments. I have so many doctor's appointments in the morning. You know, and having that bit of information before the IEP, you know, in case she forgot to mention that's something that, you know, you as the teacher can add to and help kind of make the parent feel seen and heard. Because that's probably the number one thing that we don't get clients that say that outright, but that's like the number one underlying reason that they're like pissed off. And then they Googled attorney, special ed, or however they found us, is they don't feel seen and they definitely don't feel heard. And you most definitely, I know for the students and then even the teachers that you're teaching, you make them feel seen and heard. And we are just so grateful for your time. And just to kind of wrap things up, if somebody wanted to connect with you, how could they do that? And then where can they find your book?
My book is available on any website, book retailer. Love is a Classroom, Andrew D.L. Goff. I can be reached at Andrew D.L. David Lepp, Goff at gmail.com. I also have a website, which is, it's got two different domain names, andrewdlgoff.com or loveisaclassroom.com. You put in either one of them, you'll get to me. There's contact information. I also have a podcast, Love is a Classroom, where I try to elevate the voices of families also. And, you know, teachers don't have the privilege of sitting down and spending 2 years writing a book like I do, but that doesn't mean they don't have stories and experiences to share. And then social media, Look up Love is a Classroom or Andrew D.L. Goff, and you'll find me there too.
Thank you again so much for your time, Andrew. You are definitely a gem, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Vicki and Amanda. I really appreciate it.
And to our listeners, we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.